You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or subscribe to Brookings Podcasts through iTunes or your favorite podcast app. You can also follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Brookings. I'm Michael Hanlon with the Foreign Policy Program, and I have the privilege of moderating today's discussion on crises and conflicts in the broader Middle East region. And we have an all-star panel to help us through that set of subjects, which, of course, are interrelated, but also involve a number of specific and distinct countries and conflicts. And so we hope that today's discussion will provide some insights on some of the conflicts and broader concerns that are afflicting the region, but also perhaps some new ideas on what to do about them. What we're going to do in terms of procedure today is to begin with a couple of questions that I'll pose, sort of working down the panel. Taking stock first of where we are on some conflicts and getting people's quick briefing on how things look in regard to the specific country or problem they're most expert in. And then I'll take a second round of questions, which is to assess current strategy as well as to propose improvements to that strategy where necessary for whichever country or concern the person is most interested in. And that will be American policy, but also broader NATO and European policy towards these conflicts, broader regional strategies within the Middle East region as well. And then we'll look forward after some discussion to your questions and comments. I've got my, let me begin at the far side. General John Allen, batting cleanup, will help tie things together, but we'll work starting on the panelists closest to me. And let me introduce each one of them briefly. General Allen, as you know, was coordinator of the international campaign against ISIS in his last government job before joining Brookings roughly 2 years ago. Before that, he had been the commander of the International Security Assistance Force in Afghanistan, although we're probably not going to look that far east today unless your questions bring us in that direction. And of course, he is now the newly named president of Brookings, which we're all thrilled about, and especially because it's, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Adding to my joy is the fact that this is not a Washington job subject either to Senate confirmation or to Dan Snyder's deliberations, and therefore he will begin on November 6th. And it's just wonderful news.
Thanks, Mike.
Next to John is Mara Carlin, who is also a Brookings scholar, a non-resident scholar, but she is not too far away in her other job, which is at the School of Advanced International Studies across the street with Johns Hopkins University. Until late last year, she was a high-ranking Pentagon official on the subjects of strategy and force development. And she's just back from a recent extensive trip to the broader Middle East where she went, among other places, to Jordan and Iraq. Moving again closer towards me is Dan Byman, our longstanding colleague here in the Foreign Policy Program, one of the nation's preeminent experts on counterterrorism, as well as many other subjects within the broader Middle East. And counterterrorism will essentially be his initial subject today, but he'll be able, I'm sure, to range far and wide as we talk about specific countries as well. He's also a professor and dean at Georgetown University, and we're just thrilled to have him here. His most recent book from a couple of years ago is essentially a primer on Al-Qaeda, ISIS, and everything you need to know about terrorism. A very well-written and very accessible book that remains quite timely. And last and certainly not least, and our visiting non-resident fellow from Italy, a little further than ICE, than SICE, but here for the week and here periodically throughout the year with us is my good friend Federica Saini. She is a scholar in Italy, an historian, a trained nurse. She's written on Libya from many vantage points over the years, including contemporary challenges facing that country, but also a fantastic historian on earlier epochs and periods in Italy's modern history. And so, again, with your permission, what I'll do is I'll begin sequentially, starting with Mara, looking at Iraq and Syria. And then I'll come to Federica, and we'll talk about Libya. And then Dan talking about counterterrorism, and John Allen sort of stitching it all together. So without further ado, Mara, the floor is yours.
Thank you. It's really a treat to be here, even if I only had to effectively walk across the street. So as we look at the situation in Iraq and Syria, there are a couple issues that I'm in particular noticing, having been to the region pretty recently. On Iraq, there's really two pieces that I'm looking at. Number one is, what will this soon-to-occur military victory over ISIS How will it manifest? What will it look like? And there's a number of different pieces within that. Reconciliation, what will political reconciliation amongst the different parties look like? What will stabilization and reconstruction look like? Having spent a lot of time walking around places like Mosul, I can tell you there is profound destruction, entire blocks that are destroyed, hospitals. For those book lovers in the audience, the Mosul University Library, which held 2 million books, was torched by ISIS, for example. And you are seeing a lot of people who have been displaced, millions in fact, internally across Iraq. And what will it look like as they start to go home? What kind of faith will they have in Baghdad's ability to reestablish some sort of sovereignty throughout its territory and just fix all of this profound destruction? And then, of course, inherent in that, there's this pesky referendum that recently occurred up in the north, where you see a pretty decent swath of Iraqi Kurds supporting a different type of future for themselves, and one that is much, much more loosely tied to Baghdad, indeed, their own country. When I was there, a lot of Kurdish leaders seemed to be surprised at the tumult and uproar that this referendum had caused. Probably unsurprisingly to many of us, the leaders in Baghdad were not terribly excited over this referendum, thought it came out of the blue, and thought the timing was inopportune, to say the least. So what will happen going forward? It seems to me we have some pretty terrible options. If you look at what an independent Kurdistan might be, it would probably be no doubt landlocked, but also surrounded by neighbors that aren't excited about it. Afghanistan comes to mind, and that's not a terrific geographical place to be in. Other alternatives like confederation might exist, but that may in many ways be the worst of all worlds for Baghdad. So moving beyond the Iraq piece, as we turn to Syria very briefly, not only do we see a humanitarian catastrophe that only worsens, as we are all familiar with over the last few years, but increasingly the question will be, what does reconstruction look like for Syria, and who plays a role in that, and who can be most relevant in that? It's a pretty dire situation where one of the better options happens to be the authoritarian strongman who has been responsible for the murder of many of his people, perhaps staying in power. I'll stop there. Thanks.
Mara, amazingly concise and helpful. I am going to quickly give you one follow-up on Syria, which your question sort of raises in my mind, which is, do you, as you talk about reconstruction, begin to anticipate the war winding down? Is that sort of what's happening? I mean, we know that Assad has consolidated control of some parts mm-hmm. of the country, but there's also the whole northwest up and around Idlib, which is still a hornet's nest. There's still a number of towns in the east where ISIS either has some hold or competition between Hezbollah and Assad on the one hand and U.S.-affiliated forces elsewhere. But would you still sort of think of the overall conflict as beginning to wind its way gradually down?
I think that's the case. In particular, talking to many interlocutors who are going in and out of different parts of Syria, that's really their observation also. I don't know that we will sit here a year from now and say the line has been drawn, but we are increasingly on a trajectory where, as you noted, Assad has consolidated increasing control and is getting increasingly comfortable. And, you know, I think for any of us who spend years thinking about this issue, we can't help but reflect on how different that conversation is from, say, 5 years ago, where the question of what Assad's future would have looked like was much more open and dynamic.
So I know we'll come back to these questions as we get into Dan and John's thoughts on counterterrorism in the broader region. But first, Federico, we'd love to get your sense of just how we should think about Libya today. And again, welcome to Brookings. Wonderful to have you here. And I know the subject we've asked you to address is not necessarily so happy, but look forward to your wisdom.
Thank you, first of all. And okay, the situation in Libya is incredibly difficult because on one side, we have some good move from the international community, and we had a new special envoy for Libya from UNSMIL, and who is a Lebanese and a very well and very well prepared man. So he's moving in a very good way, and it seems that he's been accepted by the international community. The point of Salamé is in this very moment to be united all together, because one of the most the biggest problem in Libya has been division, not only in the terrain, on the terrain in Libya, but between the external actors who are playing the game, their game in the chessboard. So on one side we have the program, the international program of Salamé, which is very good. And on the other side, we have the real Libya, so the terrain, what's happening right now. In the very few days, the last few days, we had many clashes of every kind, you know, every different kind of clashes. Militias in Benghazi, for example, and in Tripoli, tribal. One tribe against the other, like Werfalla and Gaddafi. And then we had a huge attack in Misrata, made by ISIS probably, and so with dead, and so the situation, even though the international community seems this time to be aligned, on the ground, the situation is very difficult, incredibly, in the very last week. So we will see. I mean, Libya is always a surprise.
So a couple of additional points before we go to Dan, if I could. Just thank you for laying the picture so clearly, laying it out so well. You mentioned to me earlier that Libya is in this strange place where even though it doesn't really have a state, it does now have a fair amount of oil revenue coming back. Could you explain a little bit about that, but I think also why it's not getting to the people and why it's not getting where it needs to?
Okay. In Libya, there are... the point of Libya is that, in my opinion, is not a state. When we talk about the failed state, I also wrote about a failed state last year, but the point is that Libya has never been a state since the Ottoman Empire. So, not a state in those times, not a real state during the Italians. And with the Gaddafi, was a strange state as well, because the Rais did not invest in anything. And on the contrary, he pushed for division in the country and did not build anything about administration, institutions, and so on. So the country is completely to be built from nothing. And on this side, on the other side, we have some institution like the Central Bank of Libya or the NOC, the society that controls the revenues from oil. Oil is fundamental in Libya. It's the richness of the country. There's nothing else. And but on the other side, everything is disrupted. So even though Libya is one of the best producer of oil in the world, with the best oil, Libyans usually do not have now fuel. So, for example, in Seba, just 2 days ago, the elders of the city, Seba is in the Fetsan, so in the desert in the south, they said that they are going to stop two very important oil fields in the area because they don't have nothing, no fuel, and so here we are.
That's one last question, just to try to complete my basic understanding of Libya, and then we'll move on to Dan and John. But when the United Nations or other international agencies talk these days of the countries that are at the most acute stress and risk for humanitarian purposes, where the greatest number of people are at risk, they don't tend to include Libya on the list that I've seen. I know Libya's got a smaller population.
Yes, by millions.
But you know, they talk about Yemen, they talk about Syria, they talk about Somalia, Central African Republic, parts of Nigeria. These are the areas that we're hearing the most discussion about. So that leads me to ask you, is Libya sort of finding a way to scrape by, even though there's no real central government with any control or power, there's no real agreement on its political future, there's no real functioning state, and yet somehow they're averting the worst Or is it even more dire than I suspect and that I've appreciated when you actually look on the ground? It just sort of escaped people's attention because it's on the sort of on the periphery of the broader Middle East, but things really are almost as bad as in Yemen or Syria. Can you help me understand
that? No, the situation right now is not so bad as in Yemen or in Syria, of course. But anyway, you have to think that the population is very is a tiny population in a huge territory. Because Libya is as big as Alaska, so and there are only few cities all around the country where you can live. But anyway, Libyans are used to do alone by themselves, and for example, in the Fezzan, all tribes there are this kind of now are. No more semi, so semi-nomadic as during the Italian occupation. But all these tribes and villages, they are used to do by themselves since the time of Gaddafi, Italians, and so on. So for them, even though there is no state, they can do by themselves anyway.
Right, right. Thank you. We'll come back to Libya as we come back to other countries as well. But Dan, over to you to give us a broader lay of the land on counterterrorism challenges in the region.
Well, as with most problems, there's some good news and there's some bad news. If you look at the most important groups from an American perspective, there's actually a lot of good news. Right? So Al-Qaeda, for many years, has been largely inactive as a core organization. It's been unable to conduct significant international attacks. Those that have been done or tried have largely been through its affiliates, not the core organization. And heavy pressure on the core group has largely succeeded. And we have a fair amount of evidence from within the group to support that. It's been more successful, though, in spreading its branches at a regional level. And I'll come back to that point. If you look at the Islamic State, as Mara began saying, there's been significant military successes. Right? Its territory has shrank dramatically. And part of the appeal of this group was that it was a winner. And it's no longer a winner. Right? It's been hit extremely hard. We've seen recruitment dry up dramatically. We've seen fundraising dry up dramatically. And that creates, from a U.S. perspective, a benign cycle, where the group gets weaker as these successes continue, and the weakness makes the successes easier. But the caveats are the eternal question for the Middle East, which are what's next? Right? One thing the United States has historically been very good at is defeating adversaries in fixed territories. And it's been not nearly as good at the question of governance afterwards. And so we've seen the Islamic State or its predecessors go underground in the past, notably in Iraq at the end of the last decade, and then reemerge when the conditions were right. And right now, in their own propaganda, they're making that point. We've seen Al-Qaeda adapt to U.S. pressure and try to spread its network to different affiliate groups. And what makes this, I would say, even more concerning in the long term is the speed at which the Islamic State itself was able to reestablish itself as the Syrian war broke out shows how deeply rooted many of the ideas in the broader jihadist world have become. And so it was able to tap into very deep roots that had been planted by previous generations, and it was able to harvest that. And the Syrian civil war has added to that. So the next time there's a crisis, and I think we can all agree there will be another crisis in the Middle East, the next time there's a crisis, other groups may be able to take advantage of that. And they were also able to take advantage of that by very skilled use of information technologies. And the rapid dissemination of these technologies has proven a major boon to these groups. And I would say the United States and more broadly global governance hasn't quite figured out how and to what degree it wants to regulate these technologies. And the technologies are often moving much more quickly than is policy. So I think, you know, right now the United States is, you know, really getting ready to regulate MySpace, right? I mean, we're really, you know, able to regulate platforms and, excuse me, that people don't really use that much anymore. And it's very hard if you ever work in government to be able to move very quickly in response to an emerging problem. But that's going to be a constant challenge. Another very troubling event has been the ability of terrorism to shape politics in the West. And in general, in the past, we've seen terrorist attacks happen, but they've often led communities to come together. Many of these attacks have not been terribly effective, but they've led us to come apart. And they played into very deep schisms in the West, in Europe and the United States, that have often been Muslim communities demonized by non-Muslim communities, but more broadly feeding into anti-immigrant sentiment. And this has had a profound impact on the nature of governments in a number of countries, including the United States. And that's a profound impact of terrorism beyond lives lost. It's a strategic impact. It's something that it goes beyond what at least I think we've seen in the past. And the last thing I'll say, which is to me very troubling, is that the Middle East is consumed with civil wars. So, of course, Mike mentioned Yemen, and, of course, we've heard about Syria and Iraq, and we've heard about Libya, right? We could add to this if we want to expand the region a little bit, if we want to talk about Somalia, if we want to talk about Afghanistan, if we want to talk about parts of Central Asia. And even the countries that are not in deep civil wars have a lot of stability problems. And terrorists feed on civil wars, right? It's a tremendous advantage for these groups. They're able to gain space to operate. They're able to put themselves as defenders of communities. They're able to bring in fighters. And it's very hard to beat a terrorist group by only going after terrorists, right? You have to solve broader problems of society and governance that are allowing these groups space to operate. And that's an exceptionally difficult problem, and one that's gotten worse rather than better.
One quick follow-up to you before I go to General Allen. Is there one place in the Middle East, Dan, where the current Al-Qaeda or ISIS presence worries you the most? So we see ISIS sort of in retreat in the east of Syria, certainly in Iraq. We know that Al-Qaeda has some presence in Yemen. We know that the Al-Qaeda derivative has some ongoing presence in northwestern Syria. And then we know that some of these groups have had toeholds in parts of Libya and elsewhere, as well as the Sinai. Is there any place where, as you point out, there are longer-term concerns about where it could reappear? But this sort of broader jihadist Salafi movement, is there a place where today it's maybe stronger than people commonly recognize?
So I'll give three answers to that, which is kind of cheating. One is that even as the Islamic State has been hit hard in Syria, the Syrian branch of Al-Qaeda, which there are debates about the level of alignment, but I'll go with that for the moment, has been very successful in integrating itself with a range of rebel groups. And it has very deep roots. And it is poised to pick up a lot of the pieces from the shattering of the Islamic State. Yemen has benefited tremendously from the civil war there, and in particular, the Saudi and UAE operations there, which has enabled this group to, again, gain some space and some ability to operate. And I don't think the Al-Qaeda group in Yemen is incredibly strong, but it's stronger than it was several years ago. And the last country I'll name is actually not in civil war, which is Tunisia. Tunisia has a democracy. It's a very fragile one. But it also has a Salafi problem and a violent Salafi problem. And the largest number of recruits for the Islamic State are Tunisian from a per capita point of view. And so I am tremendously worried that many of these people will return and they'll inject violence in an already fragile situation and take a country that for now is limited success and turn it the other way around.
Excellent for laying out the background so well. So, John, over to you, please, to go where you'd like to tie these pieces together, present your thoughts on the broader region, and if you'd like to, you know, begin the policy discussion as well about where we should be going next.
Sure. Thank you. It's great to be on this panel with such good friends. Dan, every member of the panel has already touched some of these issues. Dan hit a couple of them hard. I want to reiterate what he said. But I start with a story. I was the deputy commander of the Central Command in the late winter of 2010 and the early months of 2011, which is what has been the so-called Arab Spring. I have a little experience with these things called tsunamis. And tsunami is not a single wave, it's multiple waves. And I would really rather rename the Arab Spring to the Arab Tsunami, because what's happening and what has happened is as we watched literally the fire of the Arab tsunami burn its way across North Africa coming towards us in the Middle East, and we did the analysis on it, what we discovered is, goes to Dan's point, because Al-Qaeda at the time was attempting to make the case that what was happening in this broader collapse, if you will, of governance across the region was a direct result of the success of Salafi jihadist doctrine and the spread. The truth, of course, was Al-Qaeda was attempting to sprint out ahead of what was, in fact, a broad failure of governance and societies across the region. Spurred in many cases, by, for the first time, the widespread use of social media. And we watched this very closely, because as Tunisia came apart, the capacity for that level of success, of societal disintegration, was vastly magnified by virtue of social media. Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, all of those things were conveying that in one country after another, when the society rose up, it was achieving effect. And the problem with so many of these societies was the failure of governance and the failures of society to deliver on the expectations of a mega trend which has occurred in that region and is occurring broadly across the world, which is that a large portion of all those societies were aged roughly 15 to 29 or so. And these young men and women had real expectations for their futures, because in many respects they had been exposed to in some extent or another to what 15 to 29-year-olds were achieving in other countries as well. And so, no access to education, corrupt judiciaries, predatory security forces, the failure of inclusivity, an absence of the rights for women, and virtually no economic prospects. And we began to see what should have been self-evident to us all along. So Dan hit it right on the head. It was a tsunami. But tsunamis are characteristic by not the first wave, but by multiple waves. It's the damage of the follow-on waves that is really the lasting damage. I think we have not seen the end of what began as what was called the Arab Spring, because across this region, in virtually every one of these countries, we haven't seen a major repair or a major change of the conditions under which so many young men and women were radicalized and so brought away, pushed into the arms of extremists, and ultimately became violent extremists or terrorists, joining Daesh or Al-Qaeda or Ansar Bit al-Maqdis or Ansar al-Sharia. So that's my fear. My fear is that the unhinging, if you will, of the societal links within the governments across the entire region, across North Africa, across the Middle East, and again, my own experience in the Middle East, but also my own experience in Afghanistan, it unleashed a whole series of forces. And it has left for us generally weak governments that in the broadest sense have not really been able to repair the deficiencies or remain very weak on the one end of the spectrum. But on the other end of the spectrum, we find that the civil wars have created in and of themselves incubators for the expansion of Salafi jihadism, but continued and expanded social instability as well. That's the broader Middle East, if you will. And the challenge, of course, is much bigger than that. There's a strategic challenge to this. And it's because so many individuals from North Africa, and I think if Dr. Sayani will touch this later, we haven't any idea yet how many refugees could come out of North Africa if there is another collapse societally across the Maghreb or more deeper into the Sahel. But what we have seen is that the large numbers of migrants and refugees that have come out of the civil wars in the more localized traditional Middle East have destabilized what we know in many respects is Europe today. It has been a direct blow upon the cohesion of the European Union. It has polarized politics. It has forced polarization of the political spectrum, in many cases seeing nativist, neo-Nazi type organizations emerge because of the presence of large numbers of people of color now being inserted into these societies, which is unfair in many respects. But it's also brought with it waves of violence and waves of terrorism. And those of you who've been to Paris recently, or those of you who've been in almost any of the major European cities, what you have seen are paramilitary police or paratroopers, etc., guarding large-scale public areas or synagogues or other spots like that. So there's a strategic implication to this. And so let me hit just the policy issue here, and that is that we have, I think, as a country, but more broadly as a community of nations, we've failed to recognize that this broad, continuous failure of the addressing of these underlying causal factors permits the subsequent waves of the tsunami. And in an environment where, for all intents and purposes, we've declared war on Islam by saying we're going to be oriented on fighting radical Islamic terrorism, and that's the wrong term for it. This is Salafi jihadist terror, more so than radical Islamic terror, because in that term we inappropriately paint Muslims as the problem or Islam as the problem, and that is not the problem. It's a doctrine, a malevolent doctrine that has the capacity to spread into disaffected populations because we haven't solved the underlying problems that exploded in our faces with the so-called Arab Spring. So if war is our only option, then war is all we'll ever have at a time when we're cutting the State Department's budget and USAID, et cetera. And at a time when we should be leading the community of nations, from my perspective, in a broad-based approach to stabilize countries and to help countries that are in distress to begin to address some of these societal issues, which can turn around this vast radicalization engine which drives the fighters into the arms of Daesh and Al-Qaeda and these other groups. So that's the problem that I see, Mike, and I will just make more focus on this, and Dr. Siani could comment if she likes. I think the U.S. has a huge blind spot on North Africa. I don't believe that we fully understand what's happening in Libya. I don't think we fully understand or fully appreciate or fully embrace at a policy level what we can do to stabilize Egypt. If Egypt goes over the edge, we are all in serious trouble. And there are other elements within North Africa that demand our attention immediately. So this discontinuous strategic approach that sees the Middle East in blocks, one separate from the other, instead of seeing from where the Atlantic washes the coast of Morocco all the way across the Middle East, perhaps to Afghanistan, to try to create one comprehensive and cohesive approach within which then there will be more focused functional strategies. Until we're able to do that as a community of nations led by the United States, we're just going to see one subsequent wave of the tsunami after another, and each one will be progressively worse because we have not been able to recover from the previous one.
Thank you. Let me ask you, John, one more question on that, and then we'll just work down the panel with the same question really for anybody and everybody. Don't feel the need to solve every problem in the Middle East with your specific next points, but if there's one burning recommendation that you've got, one specific thing that we're not doing and we really could do better, one or two things like that, love to hear it. And then that'll be a good way to start the conversation with the audience. But John, as you lay out the need for an integrated strategy, I guess my question would be, is there one or maybe two main areas where you see that we're doing things inadequately now, in addition to the lack of a bigger vision that you talked about already? Is it in terms of economic assistance? Is it in terms of our diplomatic relationships with some of the countries? Is it in terms of how to think about the Muslim Brotherhood and find some moderate ranks among that broader group in the region and work with them? I just don't know if there are specific things that you would want to add to your list as well.
And the answer is yes. It's all of those things. The first and foremost, from my perspective, while I am interested in political stability or I'm interested in our diplomatic relations, those are very important, and those can be enhanced, although right now we're having some difficulties with that. But we will fail if we don't work at an economic solution in many of these countries, because economic stability generates opportunities that many young men and women would never be able to have on their own. There's this wonderful statistic, I think the World Bank put it out. It's 129 million young men and women become 16 every year. And roughly 80% of them live in developing countries with fragile governments. So the likelihood of that swath of the youth finding for themselves a future in that country and being unable to leave it, or if they do leave it, I think we know where they're going, and being unable to leave it, they are hugely susceptible as a population to radicalization. If I were to want to say where we must consider at the grand strategic level a broad direction, it's at the economic level of this. And if we can change the economic prospects, then the politics can cure itself, as we've seen in other places, and the diplomacy becomes easier. But if we do not ultimately address the economic issues, then I think we're, let's get ready for the next wave.
Thank you. Mara, over to you. And you've got an equally impossible challenge of trying to talk about both Iraq and Syria. So if you prefer to take one or the other, whatever policy advice you would offer at this time.
Great. Thank you. I would agree with John's diagnosis. I think it is spot on with the sort of maelstrom that we see regionally. And I very much appreciate his policy prescription that at the end of the day, it's economics we need to worry about. I think if both of us were still sitting in our defense hats, we would have said, thanks for all of the funding, $600+ billion, maybe just direct a little bit more of that to the State Department or USAID, because it can really have a much bigger effect, frankly, on that front. The concern I have right now, and perhaps my biggest recommendation, would be surrounding Iran. I think the issue about recertification and what to do with the nuclear agreement is a little bit of an inconvenient distraction when the other challenge Iran poses is really up in our face at this moment in time, which is Iran's destabilizing and meddlesome behavior across the Middle East. And just to take one case study, which makes it extra hard, you could look at Iraq. So Iranian-supported militias have played a pretty substantial role in the rollback of countering ISIS. That makes the challenge there a lot harder. And I can tell you they are still very much put together and still a presence across the country with their graffiti, with their flags, with their personnel manning checkpoints. So that's a real challenge. And there have been times over the years where the nuclear challenge posed by Iran and the meddlesome behavior challenge have bled into one another. And it seems this is a moment where we sure should focus a little bit more on the latter, because the Iranians are having some tremendous gains across Iraq, across Syria, of course, and more broadly regionally.
So one follow-up before we go to Dan and then Fede. You're implying, I think, that there actually are ways we can compete with Iran successfully inside of Iraq, that it's not over. Sometimes you hear Americans talk as if we've already sort of lost Iraq to Iran. I think I hear you saying that's not the case, and there are a lot of things we can do to at least be, you know, a viable alternative. Could you mention a couple of the specific ideas going forward? Should we be thinking about an indefinite security arrangement with Iraq where we commit to be there long term with training and other kinds of assistance, or maybe economic aid as well? That, of course, Iraq's economy has really been in the tank because of fallen oil prices and the war. Do you feel like we should be coming up with an aid package that's comparable for what we give to Afghanistan and Israel and Egypt, but also for Iraq? I mean, I'm just curious as to what kind of policy ideas would support your vision.
Absolutely, and what that looks like. Well, part of it is making sure we keep working with groups like the Counterterrorism Service. Mm-hmm. Part of it is ensuring you have some sort of meaningful integration of these various militias into the Iraqi military. I think economic assistance and a long-term security relationship would also be key. And some of it is really, really playing a presence and playing a role. You know, the Iraqis often feel like Iran looks to them like their little brother. And those dynamics are a lot more complicated, I think, historically than ours have necessarily been. I think that provides some important opportunities.
Great. Thank you. Dan, over to you and on the broader counterterrorism challenge and any specific countries you want to talk about, too.
Sure. I'll tackle one aspect of my remarks, which is that right now I think if you wanted to design a policy to alienate American Muslims and to a broader degree Muslims in Europe, you would do what we're doing right now, right? And a lot of that's simply rhetoric, right? Is there rhetoric from the top that's welcoming, or is there rhetoric from the top that's hostile? And I think we know the answer to that, unfortunately. Another question is in some of your policies. So do you go through elaborate lengths to create, restrictive policies on immigration that are not at all rooted in threat analysis? Yes. Are you looking at different kinds of violence and treating them equally? No. So right-wing violence in the United States gets a lot less attention, right-wing violence in Europe gets a lot less attention than similar violence done by jihadists. So it's not that you don't treat one seriously, it's that you treat them both seriously. And what I would say about all of these are more in our power to fix, right? I would love to solve the civil wars in the Middle East problem, right? And I'd like to put more resources to it. But even if we do, it's really hard, right? This is one that is much more doable. And I would say, just to focus on Europe for one quick second, I'm especially worried about the refugee problem in Europe, because I think Europe's policy at times has the seeds of its own destruction. which is taking in large numbers of people and then treating them very poorly. And I worry that it's going to be a self-fulfilling prophecy where the people are admitted and then there are hostile policies against them, they're not given the resources they need, and then 10 or 20 years from now, so not now, but 10 or 20 years from now, we're going to see problems in that community. And it's in part, ironically, the community is going to be radicalized by coming to Europe, not that they came in and radicalized Europe. Right? And I worry about that tremendously. I think it's a threat to Europe. I think it's a threat to the broader international community.
Well, that's a perfect segue for Fede to talk not only about Libya, but about Europe. So over to you, my friend.
Well, I've lived in Rome for 15 years, and I moved just 1 month ago to Milan. So I've seen the transformation of the city in the last year and a half because of the flux of migrants, and that has been really as a wave. I mean, the city has changed its face. And and Italians, the normal people, citizens, are trying to interacting with this, but this, believe me, is really a huge problem. A problem of integration, first of all, for these people, because these people are not happy, I guess, to leave their countries. And so there is always a reason. It's not just a fashion. Okay, now let's move to another country. Let's immigrate and go who knows where. But the point is that now we have a problem of security and of handling these persons, because they are they have different habits, traditions, and often they do not have houses. So now there is a problem with Italians who are waiting for public houses. And maybe they see that these kind of public houses, they were waiting for years, maybe, they are going to migrants. So I've seen in the last few weeks really clashes between police, migrants, people who were waiting for their houses, public houses. But my point is that until now I haven't seen a real strategy. The point is always strategy. It seems that our politicians are not able to give one, and everything seems to be wrong in Europe in this very moment.
One follow-up on that, and then you may want to offer a thought or two on Libya, I realize. As I understand it, refugee flows into Italy have been actually much less the last few weeks.
Yeah.
And so are you suggesting that that's probably just going to be a temporary blip and they could really get big again? Or are you saying that even if that part of the problem is beginning to be well addressed, the number of immigrants who are already in Europe just are going to have to be taken care of in a much more systematic and better way? Or even if flows were to stop tomorrow, there would still be huge problems?
It would be a huge problem anyway, because we had years with hundreds of thousands of people coming without a stop. So this is a problem anyway. I don't know, and we are trying to give an answer to this stop that, for example, in August was really big. But I think that migrants are just people who wants to leave Africa, are just waiting in the shores of Africa. So they are just waiting in Libya, and this can be an incredible problem the last problem of Libya, because they are disrupting the social fabric also in Libya, mm-hmm. because they come from the Sahel or in the sub-Saharan zone. The Sahel is in a huge crisis in the last few years has been. So the situation is not just, my point is not, the situation is not just Libya, but is Africa, all Africa. And I think we've forgotten Africa for too many years. And now, you know, all the problems are coming out.
So I've got one more question for you, then I'll invite anybody on the panel who wants to make an additional point or even ask a question of each other to do so, and then we'll go to all of you for your thoughts and questions. But even though Africa in general is a concern, specifically back to Libya, I've heard you say and read you, and a lot of Fede's writings are on our website. If you Google under Saini, S-A-I-N-I, or you know the fuller name is in your bio, then you can find her stuff, and it's great. And one of the things you've taught me is that this government of national accord in Libya, this centralized child of the UN or the international community, is really not particularly viable and not likely to become very viable. And therefore, we might be better off thinking of a more regional strategy, not formal partition of Libya, but more of a set of or a confederation of relatively autonomous regions, if I understand you correctly. Could you just speak to that question? What should be the political vision for the future of Libya?
Well, it's I should have the crystal ball, but anyway, I think that my idea I always discuss with my colleagues because I probably am the only one who thinks like this. But because Libya already had a federal state, a federal constitution during the King Idris in the 50s. But my idea is something a little bit different because observing the country and looking at all these differences, tribal, ethnic, whatever, I think that, yes, we have, of course, to have a state, a nation, but giving strength to the regions, to the local powers, because in a country, in a nation that does not exist, you cannot just work on the top. And that's, I think that was the problem in the last 6 years in Libya. Because Libya is not like other countries, like Tunisia, for example, if we want to talk about the Maghreb, which has always been a nation in every moment with its problems and so on, but a structured nation. Libya has always been a kind of a hybrid, governed in a strange way by the Ottomans, in a violent way by the Italians, in a roughly way, ruthless way by Gaddafi, but always without giving the responsibility to the Libyans. Now I think it's time to give them this choice. They have to choose what they want to be. So my idea for them is a up, you know, bottom up and up bottom policy, but really, of course, really complicated, articulated, and so on. But in the end, they have to think for themselves. What the question is? When I will be adult, you know?
Right. Thank you. Anyone else want to chime in on these many questions that are on the table before we go to the audience for a question? Anybody have a thought or an additional question for anybody else?
I'll ask a question. I don't know if either John or Mara wants to take it on, but has Assad won? Right. I mean, I was someone who very early on in 2011 was calling for strongly opposing his regime, for aiding the opposition. I've always been fairly firmly on that side. But it looks like a genocidal dictator has won a war. And it's an open question to me whether the opposition side can seriously be restarted, what the broader strategic hopes are. Is it to keep them alive, or is it to actually gain some victory? Is it to drive Assad to the negotiating table? Or do you accept that the wrong guy won the war and go with that? And I am morally, as well as, I'll say, practically troubled by any answer to those questions. But I think we actually have to ask them, exactly.
Okay, Mara, that's yours. let me take a crack at it. Time doesn't end at any particular moment. So I don't know who wins in Syria. What I would say that Assad would appear to have the upper hand in some respects right now, but he's not going to win in the end because you're exactly right. He is a genocidal dictator, and the march of time typically catches up with those guys in some form or another. Problem with Syria has been, I think, the massive policy catastrophe from the United States perspective on this issue. Had we supported those elements within the Syrian population, and they've been called a number of things, Free Syrian Army, and we are providing some support to the Syrian Democratic Force, or whatever it's being called today, had we provided that kind of support some time ago, had the at the crossing of the red line, had we taken a different action in August of 2013, I think we'd be in a very different place today. But one of the complicating factors of Syria, beyond the difficulties of the United States in forming a policy, we had, having lived this painfully, we had a strategy in Syria to defeat the Islamic State. We had a policy aspiration, ultimately, to see the end of the Bashar al-Assad regime. We had no connective tissue between our strategy and our policy aspiration. The connective tissue was empowering those elements of the Syrian population that desired to be free of him, to have political context, diplomatic capacity, and the military means by which they could both assist us in defeating Daesh, but also defending themselves from the regime until such time as they became a countervailing political force. There's where the failure occurred. We never connected the strategy with a policy aspiration, and that's the difficulty. The other problem about Syria is Syria has been a chessboard for the Cold War of the Middle East in many ways. And so you find elements within the many different militias, ones being supported by one Gulf state and others being supported by another Gulf state. The one militia is being supported against the other militia. The one militia is being supported against Daesh. The other is being supported against Bashar al-Assad. And so many of the fractures of the Gulf states and their problems are also playing out on the ground in the Middle East, or excuse me, in the Syrian civil war, where we not only are able to see a decisive end to that, but we also see that it's going to be very difficult, even if Bashar al-Assad were to declare victory, that we would see the violence end. I think the violence is going to go on for a very long time. And, of course, the Russians deserve a lot of credit for the crisis that we see there right now, and that is they have frozen in place this genocidal dictator. And not only have they frozen him in place, they've empowered him ultimately to inflict as much pain as he feels he can, because he's not being held accountable for it, as much pain as he feels he can on those elements, those dissident elements in Syria that still desire not to be governed by that regime. And the Russians have enabled him to do that. So until that ends, we are going to see violence. And I just don't see that we're going to see any kind of a comprehensive political solution in the near term.
Mara, do you care to add anything?
I think in a word, I'd probably answer yes to what you have to say. I sure hope that's only in the short to medium term. And in the long term, what we do see is that the bad guy doesn't win. But the largest reason I actually blame for this comes down to Libya. I think when the Syrian uprising first broke out, there was a plastic moment to shape what was going to happen in the future of the Levant on that front. And had the conflict with Libya not already been in motion and already not started to look a lot bumpier than many had thought, I think the U.S. response probably would have been a little different. But for all of these reasons, I think what we will see over the coming years is there will still be disputed areas. But on the whole, I suspect when we're sitting here from years, 5 years from now, Assad is still in power, and he is facing some challenges, to be sure, but he's still sitting a little pretty in Damascus, unfortunately.
Well, thank you. Let's go to you, and I'm going to take about three questions at a time. Please wait for a microphone. Identify yourself. We'll start here with the gentleman in the fourth row. I would prefer if you could ask a question. If you happen to be able to direct it primarily to one person, then we'll be able to be the most efficient. But if that doesn't work for you, I'll accept any question. Over to you, sir.
Thank you. So my name is Adam Early. I'm a sort of think tank rat, like most of the people here. My question is...
It's Ambassador Early, is that
Yeah, Ambassador
okay,
Early.
So I'm going to out you.
President John. Question really, I guess, is to maybe everybody, but I get John and maybe you, Michael, because you know a lot about this also, or Daniel is, on the tsunami point. The question would be, are governments in the region capable of governance along the lines that you suggest are necessary, bearing in mind that their primary motivation seem to be either staying in power or preserving the privileges of those to whom they owe their power?
Thank you. I'll take a second question here. Actually, both these two in the fourth row, and then we'll go back to the panel for answers.
Hello, my name is Megan. I'm from Search for Common Ground, and I have a question for John as well. The crisis in Yemen, no one can deny that there are so many human rights abuses going on, and a lot of the peace process has been blocked by regional actors like the UAE, Saudi Arabia, and Iran. And I was wondering what your thoughts of what American policymakers can do, as well as the international community can do to kind of break through those problems.
And then finally, yes, sir.
Stephen Shore, my question is about Turkey, which I think has gone unmentioned. Is there a role for Erdogan to play, and is the role he is playing that which we would like him to play?
So why don't we start, General Allen, with you, and we'll just work, take whichever questions you like, and then we'll just work down the panel to see what's left.
Just making my notes here. To the ambassador's point, and he was very helpful to us for a long time in the Middle East, so thank you for your service there. There's no clean answer to this question. Each one of those governments is very different. Each one of those governments has its own relationship to the populations. And what I would propose is that the kinds of remediation which we would seek to achieve in each one of those states is going to look different by virtue of what both the state has the capacity to absorb, but also what the state's willing, what risk the state is willing to take in making these changes. And I would also stipulate that the change will not be fast. And if we can earmark and target certain of the institutions in these states, because none of these states want to be unstable, and many of these states will be very happy to have a strategic relationship with the United States and the community of nations that can solve some of their stability problems. If we're able to agree with those states, and it'll be different with each one, on what aspects of the societal instability we can address, then I think we have a hope of making some progress there. There will be some states that will be utterly resistant to any foreign assistance, and I think those we isolate, those we contain if necessary, because it will be those that go over the edge first, and we'll see, as you pointed out, the second wave or the third wave, etc. But as you do, I know a number of the leaders in the region, and we're seeing efforts in some of the countries for genuine reform. But that reform is both limited by political capacity, risk aversion potentially to the speed with which reform can occur. But there are, that, and that's governmental reform by and large, but there are elements within these societies such as improved medical care for the populations, greater access to education, a broader approach to the role of women in societies that they are really willing to undertake but don't really have the capacity or the expertise to do that. And so what I would propose is that there isn't a single cookie-cutter approach to all of them. Each one is different. It will require that we have sufficient knowledge ourselves with our international partners to be able to provide the nuanced support to each to incrementally change those factors that cause instability. It's not going to be a short-term process. We didn't arrive here last Thursday, and we're not going to solve it next Tuesday. It's going to be a generational issue. But it's got to start. And if it doesn't start, then we'll have successive waves. And we'll see what Europe looks like in 20 years after another couple waves of millions of migrants if we have a major failure in the Sahel. On Turkey, we have seen a major change, I think, in how Turkey has where we thought Turkey would be. When I began the process of being the special envoy to the Global Coalition, I remember a conversation in the sit room one day where we said, look, we see no options in Syria. I mean, Syria was just impenetrable in the context of there was no American foothold. We weren't sure whether Turkey was in the game or not. In defense of the Turks, the Turks weren't sure whether we were committed to the game or not. Turns out we weren't really. And then I was dispatched to Ankara to work with the Turks to try to get our strike fighters out of the Gulf and into Turkey. And that's where we began to see the combination of the coalition working closely with the Turks on issues of control of the flow of foreign fighters going in and coming out, etc. We began to see real opportunity begin to unfold. But that was ultimately eclipsed, I think, by the Russian intervention into Syria. and the sense by the Turks that judging the commitment of the U.S. policy to Syria, their continued stability, both in terms of their continued stability vis-a-vis the region and their continued stability vis-a-vis their persistent conflict with the PKK, was best served ultimately by creating stability in Syria, which was judged by the Russian relationship with Bashar al-Assad. I don't know what's in President Erdogan's thinking on any particular issue, but if you judge by the conduct as opposed necessarily to the rhetoric, Turkey, of course, is very interested in stability. It's internal stability and regional stability. And regional stability, I believe, was judged not going to come out of American policy. It ultimately is going to come from the Russian incursion and its support for the Syrians. And if that stability kept Turkey stable, my sense was that they were going to line up on that. Best I can do on that one.
Thank you. Mara, any further thoughts?
Sure. Your question, Ambassador Early, reminds me of Russian literature. All of these governments are unhappy, but each in their own way. And I think that's notable, particularly when we're in this dynamic period across the region. You probably remember in 2002 when a group of Arab scholars came together and said, hey, this region has these three gaps, these three deficits, right? This knowledge deficit, this freedom deficit, and this female deficit. When we fast forward to where we are today, those all look very different than they did, I think, as John was absolutely referring to. So that's a pretty bumpy trajectory. Invariably, some of these governments are doing a better job at it. They do all want to stay in power, and they're all constantly making deals. I think we could probably say the same, though, about U.S. governments and European governments, too. But the long period of stasis that we saw along those three key lines no longer exists, and that dynamism is up in the air. On the Turkey front, it's unfortunately become an old refrain now that saying Turkey's backsliding into authoritarianism means we should get rid of the backsliding and the into in that statement. I think we see some really profound problems with Turkey these days, and we see that vis-a-vis Europe and vis-a-vis the Middle East, which are, you know, inconvenient at best. If we look just specifically at some of the issues we've talked about here, what worries me profoundly is how they're treating the Syrian refugees, how much tougher their lives are becoming right now, pushes to have them get forced back into Syria, and what that might play out as.
Thank you. Dan?
I see part of the problem in the Middle East as the Sisi problem, which is our hope for many Middle Eastern countries is they'll have a kleptocratic, somewhat incompetent, repressive dictator who has basically, you know, declared war on part of his own population, right? And that's a relative success, right? If you were in most Middle East countries, you'd happily trade places with that. And one thing we used to talk about many years ago were the three R's in the Middle East, right? We talk about rhetoric, rent, and repression, right? That these governments had a degree of revolutionary legitimacy that they drew on. They had revenues going into the state that they could sprinkle among key groups to buy off dissent. And then they beat people up, put them in jail, or killed them if they didn't pay attention. I think we're down to one R now, and that R doesn't work too well in many countries. And so these countries have to have a new system, or they have no system. And my hope in 2011 was that this was a transition point to a new system, that the legitimacy would be restored, and that as a result, these governments would be able to have real economies that were not dependent on a relatively small number of natural resources. But it's been the opposite. It's been the failure of institutions. So I think there is a tremendous failure of governance. And what I worry about, and here I'll put my professor hat on, is as a professor, we talk about regional contagions, that you can have a country that's actually doing reasonably well, but it gets swept away by the forces in its neighborhood. And given the sheer number of civil wars and their range in the region, I worry about how they're going to affect neighbors that would otherwise be stable, but are kind of trapped by the eddies that are created by these larger waves.
Jordan.
Well, I'd like to add just a few words as an historian. There was the Viceroy of Ethiopia, who was a member of the Savoia family, who in 1937 said, Democracy is a very dangerous tool to handle. And he was referring to taking a kind of democracy in Ethiopia in those times. So I think that all these nations trying during the Arab Spring, for example, and in the Middle East to have a kind of democracy, and the mistake has been maybe done by the international community that did not understand the difficulty of these kind of processes and the danger. And so I think that every country has a long way to go, and I'm referring in this very moment on Libya, for example, to reach democracy in the right way for the country, which is different by the others, of course.
I think Fedi couldn't be more right, and this is an important point. We often mistake in the U.S. Seeking to implant democratic processes in countries
exactly. That
have no democratic institutions.
And
so we've got to be very, very careful about in this plan that the ambassador would be interested in hearing. We got to be very careful about conditionalizing what we would want to do to help them to change the human condition, to improve the lot of women, to improve the capacity of civil society, etc. Be very, very careful about conditionalizing that on the embracing of a democracy or a democratic process. We've gone to the process before and it hasn't worked out because democratic institutions didn't exist. And when the vote occurred, it completely disrupted, in many respects, the outcome. Mm-hmm. This doesn't mean we aren't committed to democracy. We have to be committed to democracy. But there are going to be some aspects of how we can support that can lead others. And so while we should emphasize that where we would like to see democracy take root, we've got to be very careful about conditionalizing the support that we could offer to these countries that can fundamentally or even profoundly change the human condition in that regard. And we did not get to the one question, and I would ask if anyone wanted to talk about potential U.S. policy penetration into the Yemen civil war and how we might make a difference there.
Yeah, we'll see if we can get to that. I agree with you. I think maybe I'll try to weave that into a second round of questions from the audience. But Fedi, you wanted to add one quick note, I think.
Yes, talking about democracy, when everything in Libya happened in 2011, immediately the international community, looking at the rebels against Gaddafi, said, okay, we have to help them. Without thinking just for a moment that Gaddafi had a huge bunch of followers in the country.
I'll take it back.
And without understanding that there was a real civil war, because Gaddafi, and still nowadays Gaddafi, had the idea of Gaddafi has a huge bunch of followers. So that's why that was the first mistake. Why are you deciding to help one side? I know that it's very difficult what I'm saying, but why you are deciding to help one side or the other? Because behind Gaddafi there was a population. So it was a civil war. So we have to pay really attention in every kind of, in the idea of entering in such internal dynamics. We have to help, of course, but pay very much attention.
Thank you. Go ahead.
If I could just add one addendum to that from a very selfish Washington point of view, which is that the involvement in Libya also played into broader dynamics, because I think a U.S. perspective was that the British and the French said we had to go in, and they were very fast and far ahead.
Oh, I know.
And then as the conflict started, of course, suddenly the U.S. military had to play a role that wasn't quite expected. Things were a lot bumpier than had been thought, and suddenly, next thing you know, you're sort of embroiled in this. And so that legacy is profound on the internal side, but also on the kind of bilateral and even multilateral side.
So let's have a second round, and then we'll come back here and also introduce the Yemen question. So go to Marjorie, and then stay on that row, and then we'll come up front.
Marjorie Sonnenfeld, friend and admirer of Brookings, and I would like to congratulate General Allen.
Thank you.
Thank you, and congratulate Brookings for making such a choice. Thanks to all the panelists. They're very important contributions, and I was glad that Mara brought up Iran and General Allen brought up Russia. But is it possible to comment further on how the United States might handle, try to manage either or both of those? There's enough there for two more hours.
Please, stay in the same row.
Thank you very much. I concur with the comments on Brookings and General Allen and the panel. Alexander Kravitz from Insight. To pick up on, probably I'll address the question to General Allen, to pick up on, you refer to the fractures in Syria that are being, you know, the support of different Gulf actors. And even though this isn't a crisis, let's say, but I wonder if you could talk about the Saudi-Qatar differences and, you know, the implications if we're not able, you know, how we could, you know, sort of close that and what are the implications if we don't.
Sure.
Thank you.
I'm going to take two more questions from the front row, so we'll have a grand total of four this time. Go ahead, sir.
My name is James Griffin, and it's sort of a question for President Allen and Mike.
I've never been called that before. I have to tell you. It's actually frightening. Thank you.
I was wondering if you guys had any suggestions for how to roll back Iran's sort of green tendrils, sort of trying to grasp over the region.
Great. And then please over here, and then we'll go ahead with...
I'm Tomoe from Japan, and I'm just adding my question to the previous gentleman's question. So has the Qatari crisis given any impact on Iraq, Syria, and Libya, and maybe ISIS AQ staff? And also, like, we've seen that, Palestinians had a meeting in Gaza. I think that's the first time in 3 years. So does it have anything to do with the Qatari crisis? Thank you.
To tell you what, I think this time will work the other way to relieve the burden a little bit on my friend General John, since a lot of the questions were targeted to him, but maybe some of them will be partially addressed along the way. Let me begin, since one or two were towards me. I'm just going to say one thing, a piece of a way to think about our challenge with Russia, which a couple of you mentioned. And it also picks up on a subject that Mara mentioned in passing in her opening thoughts, which is how do you imagine beginning to rebuild Syria? And I think there has to be a way that we do this that is at least not incompatible with Russia's interests, because Russia's got too good of a foothold now, and pushing them out is going to be too hard, and reopening the whole war to push out Assad and Russia is not realistic in my judgment. So what I'd like to see us try to do is work harder at developing a strategy, and actually John Allen and I have written about this, where multilateral aid organizations and the United States can try to help reconstruction occur in parts of Syria that are not under Assad's direct control in the first instance, and try to create thereby not only humanitarian relief, but even some beginnings of governance structures. It doesn't have to be a permanent concept of creating autonomous regions or confederation within Syria, but it's a way to, in a sense, help the Sunnis in Syria, but at the same time recognize the power realities, that Assad's still in position, that Russia's still behind him. And what we can hopefully aspire to is a situation in which we sort of use economic leverage over time to try to help cajole and push Assad out of power, because he's not going to get this big aid package in areas that he controls as long as he's still president, by the concept that I'm articulating. In other words, this is a very, maybe it sounds hopelessly complicated, I think it's a nuanced approach that's realistic. Use economic leverage to try to help those parts of Syria where we have some influence and access, and over time, use that as a more indirect way to incentivize Assad out of power in Damascus. And it recognizes that Russia's role is not going to go away even if we wanted it to. That may be something that others agree with or not, but I think it's the beginning of a realistic way to think about how we work with Russia, or at least deconflict our approaches inside of Syria. Fedi, I don't know if you want to comment on any of the questions. We'll just keep working down the road till we get to John.
Well, about Qatar, for example, in Libya, Qatar has been a real regional problem there. But exactly like on the other side, because Qatar has always supported the Tripolitania's part, let's say this. And on the other side, we had Emirates, Russia, Egypt, and all these actors in places like Libya, so disrupted, so weak, saw in problems are really like a bomb. And so the impact of the proxy war, let's say this, between Qatar and the Emirates and Saudi in Libya has been really disrupting. And it has, plus the Russia hand and the Egypt, has completely spoiled the normal process of a kind reaching a kind of democracy there, because the Cyrenaica side, the regional actors who were supported Cyrenaica, gave a lot of power to General Haftar, for example. So all these actors inside, and that was one point of Mr. Salamé, is just to be united. Mm-hmm. In trying to solve the real problem of the country or of the countries, it depends where we are, not acting for just our interests, national interests, like Emirates, for example, against Qatar or Egypt, because it's historical, the interest of Egypt in Cyrenaica and so on. So, yes.
Thank you. Dan, any comments?
Sure. I'll try to engage both the Qatar question and the Yemen question. Part of what the United States has done historically when it's done this job well as a leader is save allies from themselves. Right? And this could be in Asia, this could be in Europe, which is to somewhat dispassionately sit back and say, what you're proposing is actually quite stupid and hurts your own interests, and we're going to push against it. And what the dispute between Saudi Arabia, the UAE, and Qatar hurts all of them. Right? If the goal was to move the Qataris away from the Iranians, it has backfired. Right? They are moving closer to the Iranians, in some degrees, out of necessity. Right? And so this is not something that certainly serves U.S. interests, but doesn't serve the interests of the states involved. And part of the traditional U.S. goal was to walk people back from the brink, and I hope we can return to that. I don't think that's a very difficult demand. Yemen is a little harder. Right? I remember many years ago, a colleague in government described Saudi Arabia's attitude towards Yemen as similar to the U.S. attitude towards Cuba under Castro, right? Which was, it shouldn't matter, but it really just got under our skin, right? It was just really far more important than it deserved to be in a political sense. And in Yemen, a lot of what the Saudi military effort depends on are varying degrees of U.S. logistical and intelligence support. And we do have considerable influence over that. And I always interpreted the U.S. Indirect support for that as really, I'll say, an exchange with Saudi Arabia for cooperation in other areas. And that's not a reasonable exchange in some ways. But it's been self-defeating for Saudi Arabia. They are at present, I will say, militarily at the limit of what I think they can accomplish. And it's time for the United States to push them into negotiations there and do so behind the scenes, right? The Saudis are an ally. We're not trying to embarrass them, but we want to work with them in a way that makes things better for Yemen, but also, I think, would serve Saudi interests.
Thank you. Mara.
On that latter point, I think Dan is just spot on as he's talking about the Qatari-Saudi-UAE dynamics. At a geostrategic level, really, really unhelpful that they somehow can't prioritize the common challenge they face with Iran over their kind of petty squabbling with one another. But that's where we are. And the U.S. can be helpful in terms of active diplomacy and trying to remind them of that. But I would caution policymakers to just remember these dynamics. At various moments over the years, there's been a desire for Gulf unity and Gulf security dialogues and what have you, all of which are really great endeavors, except that in practice, we see instead the prioritization of petty squabbling and just terribly unhelpful disunity. As it relates to the Iran question, Marjorie, it's a very, very good one. It's curious that the bad behavior that Iran has exerted over the years is right now not, I think, the top concern of the White House and others. Not least because, frankly, the history the United States has with this bad behavior is pretty personal, from U.S. Marine barracks and U.S. embassy being blown up in 1983 and 1984 to, more recently, Iran helping train and equip all sorts of nefarious groups to kill American servicemen and women in Iraq. So what can be done on that front? There's a lot of things. First and foremost, frankly, putting on a professor hat, as Dan had, I would really like someone to do some great studying on the power projection capabilities that Iran's militias like Hezbollah have learned over these last few years in Syria. You know, I think we're used to worrying about groups like Hezbollah getting enhanced training and getting more sophisticated equipment. But the last few years have actually been a watershed moment where you've seen a force have to actively fight different types of conflict and have to bring together other sorts of violent non-state actors. So I'd like to see some really good studying on that front. I'd also like to see the United States taking more steps, working with its colleagues in Europe and across the region, to try to stem the flow of fighters and weapons through various efforts like searching maritime shipments, searching air shipments, to try to stem those flows.
Thank you. And General Allen, over to you.
Just a couple of points, and Mara really hit it well. One of the things that I think the United States needs to be, I think we are in many respects, needs to be acutely attuned to is the instability of the region as a result of Iranian nefarious action as it relates directly to the security of Israel, which is, our closest ally in the region. And the question should be asked in the end, and I found myself doing this when I was at CENTCOM, disregarding the political rhetoric, disregarding the public statements, mapping the activities on the ground to see if it's creating a strategic mosaic, which in the end puts Israel at a fundamental and profound disadvantage. And it's hard for Americans necessarily to see that may be forming because you see Yemen in isolation, you see the instability in Jordan potentially in isolation, you see what's going on in Syria in isolation. They seem to be individual pictures, but if you glue them all together and you think about the work of Qasem Soleimani over the last several years, who is basically the single point of reference on much of what's happened from roughly the western third of Afghanistan all the way to Gaza, it's probably useful for us to think in terms of the large strategic picture and outcomes of Iran in setting the conditions ultimately for the strategic disadvantage of Israel, and it's worth thinking in those terms, at least considering it in those terms. And the other piece that I would say with respect to Qatar and the Emirates and Saudi Arabia, you know, the president very early along in this process offered his good offices to bring the key actors into the West Wing with the idea of mediating a solution to this and put the Secretary of State on the mission. He had the mission to do this. And as I recall, H.R. McMaster sat on the stage some time ago and sort of took us through this. The principal problem with Qatar, if you listen to the Saudis or the Emiratis or the Bahrainis, remember it's four parties, Bahrain and Egypt. When you boil it all down, it's Qatar's support for political Islam. And what that has done is it has really polarized a segment of the states in the region against Qatar in that regard, such that we see, with respect to the six parties of the GCC, we're beginning to see some perhaps permanent fragmentation there, which is never good. We will never see the Kuwaitis enter into one side or the other, even though, to his great credit, the Emir of Kuwait sought to be a mediator in this process, as he has done in the past. He should get a lot of credit for that. And we're never going to see Oman align itself on one side or the other. So what we end up seeing are a couple of partners that are outliers. We see Qatar on one side. We see the Emirates and the Kingdom on the other side. So we see the fragmentation of the GCC, and then we see, as Dan alluded to it, we see, rather than wresting Qatar from the grip of Iran, which is part of the objective here, it has pushed Qatar deeper into the arms of Iran, but has also created a relationship between Turkey and Iran with respect to Qatar's security that I don't think anyone had anticipated either. To the extent that the Turks were building a brigade-sized base camp in Qatar, and as this process began to unfold, the Turks, Erdogan, attempted to push legislation through the parliament to accelerate the deployment of a brigade of Turkish infantry into Qatar at the moment of this crisis. I think we can all imagine where that would have ended up. And happily, the president was very clear with all the partners. He didn't want to see any steel flying through the sky in the Middle East. This is going to be a political issue. It's going to be an economic issue. It's going to be a diplomatic issue, but no shooting, because almost anywhere where something comes down, it's going to land on an American, much less the civilian populations. So, my view, if I were to advise Doha or to advise Abu Dhabi or to advise Riyadh, would be take the president up on this. If the president says he's prepared to be the source for mediation, let's take him up on it. And this is an opportunity for the Americans to deliver on a desire to remain engaged in the region and to help our friends and partners ultimately unsort this, because this doesn't seem to be going anywhere very fast. And this is economically very costly to these countries as time goes on. This is the chance for the United States to become involved.
Thank you. I know we're getting very close to the end of our time, but I'm going to take two quick questions from the back part of the room.
We missed her question. Can you? Yes.
Okay, I'm sorry, John. Please.
Natan, would you like to touch that? I don't mean to
That's good.
Put a spotlight on you.
Please.
Well, I'm not sure it's going to have a...
State the question. Not everyone heard that.
Sorry. There's a question about the Palestinian. There's a summit meeting, basically, a reconciliation meeting in Gaza now with the Palestinian Authority government. A very large delegation of Fatah members coming from Ramallah, including the Palestinian prime minister, who's not himself of Fatah, but others who are. I don't think it's a direct result of the crisis in the Gulf, but it certainly is related to it. Qatar in the past has been a supporter of Hamas. But now we've seen actually dynamics in the Gaza Strip that are very different. We've seen Dahlan, who's a high official of Fatah, actually supported by the UAE or by some people in the UAE with some contact with the Hamas government. They're trying to bring reconciliation. I think there are two different aspects. One is what it does to the possibilities of Palestinian reconciliation, which is perhaps outside the purview of this panel. I think is very important and very consequential. In the wider scheme of things, I think, ironically, it's a consequence of how little attention there is given now to the Palestinian issue. If anything, in the past, we used to say Middle East peace and Middle East crisis, we were talking about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, and you'll notice that until this question, the issue hasn't come up. So if anything, my answer would be no, it's not a consequence so much of the regional affairs. It's, of course, influenced by them. The Palestinians are a small entity and therefore influenced dramatically. But if anything, it's a symptom of the reverse. I don't think that's necessarily good for Palestinians or anyone else, but I think that's the reality we're in today. Middle East crisis is no longer Israeli-Palestinian.
By the way, that was Natan Sachs, who's the director of our Middle East Center here at Brookings and is the co-sponsor of this event today. So thank you for that. And sorry we ambushed you, but that was a great answer. So I'm going to take the liberty of extending about 5 minutes, and we'll take a couple more questions just in a lightning round and then final responses from the panel here. So in the very far back, please. I'm going to try to give the back of the room a chance.
Hello, my name is Sarah, and I'm an intern here in the Brookings. As an Egyptian young woman who participated in the revolution of 2011, and maybe that question will be for Dan, I was really having aspirations of how Egypt will act, you know, during the coming 10 years to 20 years. But definitely, I was disappointed. So do you think Egypt's role in the Middle East, it's going to be improving in a sense, more strong, hopefully? Thank you.
Thank you. Let's take another, if we could. Again, towards the back here, the gentleman in the blazer.
Connor Elliott, intern at Department of State. You touched upon the current budget issues for Department of State and USAID. There's been a lot of talk about the links being made between Tillerson and Mattis and the strong cooperation between the two departments. I was wondering what possibility you think there would be for the U.S. military to act in the void of USAID and other policy enacting groups for Department of State within the Middle East.
Okay, thanks. And I think I will take one very last question. The gentleman, the very far back, as I said, this was the round for the back of the room. And then we'll just work down the aisle, starting with General Allen.
Yeah, this is Thomas Gorgisian. This question is for General Allen. First of all, thank you for your service and congratulations for being director of the Brookings.
Thank you.
When you mentioned the so-called Arab Spring and then you used the Arab tsunami, how you think this will affect the work, your understanding of Arab world or Middle East, and in particular the Brookings understanding of Arab world, because Brookings for a while, it was one of main cheerleaders or supporters of Arab Spring, the so-called Arab Spring or Arab tsunami. Second point, you said Islamic, we are not trying to be against Islam or Muslims. We are trying to be more precise and say Salafi jihadist terrorism. How you deal with this terrorism, considering the terms that you use, military approach and political understanding?
Thank you, sir. And John, over to you, please.
Sure. Well, I want to make sure I'm very clear on this issue. I don't express support one way or the other for the Arab Spring. What I support is the causal, the reasons that the Arab Spring occurred were a direct result of causal factors at a societal level. I absolutely support, and in my position of leadership here, I would like to facilitate serious thinking on how we go about the business in a systematic way of helping these countries to address those issues so that if we have additional ripples, they are inconsequential compared to the improvement ultimately at the societal level in so many of these countries, to create stability in those countries, to create stability in the region, and to create stability in the larger strategic sense of the word. The Arab Spring was symptomatic of something that was largely a function of failures of governance and failures in societies. And so we should learn from that, and we should seek to create prescriptions and assistance that can address those issues. So we should be very attentive to what happened in each one of these countries, because they're all different, and there will be different levels of willingness ultimately to remedy these problems over time. That's an important contribution this institution can make, is to think very seriously about these causal factors, recognizing, of course, the demography of the region is in many respects the great liability of the region and ultimately more broadly at the strategic level. How does that demography's aspirations for the future, how do we satisfy that? Otherwise, if we don't, then it's one ripple after another, it's one wave after another. So I think it's very important that we pay attention to the Arab Spring, the reasons for it, and how we can prevent it or at least reduce the effects of it in the future. Question about the military, and I've had some practice at this in a couple places. And the thing you learn is that in major uprisings such as in Iraq or in Afghanistan or in Bosnia-Herzegovina or in other places, and I don't like the term, but we use the term because it's very important, and that is you can't kill your way out of these issues. They didn't start typically because of a military problem. It started because of societal failure. And it ultimately evolves into an active insurgency, and the insurgency takes on either criminal or terrorist complexion to it, and that begins the process of instability. The military may necessarily be used, as I found myself in at least Iraq and Afghanistan, may be used to buy time, may be used to create white space where we can both train indigenous forces in the way that we want them to be, non-predatory and capable, while we address the societal issues that can create stability in the region. So, look, the military has a role in these, but the military isn't the solution in these. The solution, ultimately, is empowering the Department of State, which has always been the leading edge of American influence. We don't have to be very explicit about the capacity of the United States military. It is enormous. It is the most powerful military on the planet. But the great power of the United States has always been the beacon of its governance and the capacity of its aggressive diplomacy. And I mean that in a positive sense, not in a hegemonic sense. And so we should be empowering our diplomats. We should be empowering the foreign policy mechanisms of the United States and empowering the USAID and other entities that can come to the assistance of countries that want to change these desperate societal problems. The solution is not the military solution. The military is an enabler, ultimately, to the solution. The solution is at the economic, the societal, and the political and diplomatic levels.
Thank you very much. Mara.
And we want to make sure we hit Egypt, because that was an important question.
So taking that question about the U.S. military substituting potentially for USAID or the State Department, I agree wholeheartedly with John's comments, and I might emphasize three points as to why the U.S. military shouldn't play this role, from the most superficial to the most important. The most superficial, it's actually really expensive to pay for people to be in the U.S. military compared to Foreign Service Officers or USAID workers. Number two, the optics are pretty terrible. We don't want the U.S. military engaged in development projects. Finally, and most importantly, the U.S. military is an extraordinary institution. It is built to fight and win wars. If we do not use it in that way, it will no longer be as capable in doing so. And at the end of the day, that is the priority it must have.
Let me just add one thing to Mara's point. We don't want the military to be involved in diplomacy, but over the last few years, or depth of development, but over the last few years, we absolutely have. Because when the time came to move quickly for the processes of stabilizing society and moving into development, we didn't have any other options. And so the U.S. military has had to bear that burden in the absence of the real capabilities in other places. That's not to diminish what the USAID professionals and the young foreign service officers who sweated in 130 degrees in Iraq or Afghanistan have done for us. But they're not numerous enough, and the institutions don't have the expeditionary capabilities to do that. And so in Ramadi, when we're on patrol and a young sergeant picks up a tomato from an open market and says to me that this tomato is this many Iraqi dinars today, and if it goes up 5 dinars, then I can expect that there will be X number of IED blasts within a couple of weeks because no one can afford the tomatoes anymore, but they can't afford to plant IEDs to put food on the tables. This is where we find young Marine sergeants having to do both development and fighting at the same time. As Mara says, we don't want that. We don't want that. Let's empower the entities within our government that are organized and equipped and manned to do that sort of thing. That's the United States State Department.
Thank you very much. Dan.
Briefly on the Egypt question, I had hopes in 2011, too, that Egypt would play a significant leadership role in the Middle East and do so in a positive way. It's not capable of doing that today. Right? Egypt depends heavily on both open and indirect support from Gulf governments. It has a low-level civil war with parts of its in parts of its country and other parts of its country. It's repressing significant parts of its population. The legitimacy of its government is questionable, and its ability to project power in a military sense is questionable. So Egypt is still a major country in the region. It is still relatively stable, but that's about as low a bar as you get when you're comparing to other countries in the Middle East. And I would love to have a more optimistic perspective on Egypt, but I will simply say that prospects there are less bad than they are for a number of its neighbors.
And Fede, over to you for final words.
Okay. Well, as an Italian, we are very close to Egypt. We had many problems in diplomacy last year, as you probably know. And we are trying, I think, our diplomacy to understand how to deal with Libya in this way. Until now, as Dan says, Egypt has been really problematic, disrupting, and al-Sisi is in many ways I don't say dictator, but a strong, a strong leader. But in the end, all this strength is just a synonymous of weakness. And what he's doing in Egypt is really bad, in my opinion. So I really hope for you that situation will change, but not in the same way of the Arab Springs, really.
Well, listen, thanks to all of you for coming, and please join me in again congratulating President-elect Allen and thanking the panel.